Good morning, everyone. It's good to be with you this morning and sharing my thoughts with you. The topic that I want to address this morning is what I'm calling sound body, sound mind. Now, generally, we've heard this the other way around, sound mind, sound body. That is, if you have a sound mind, then you're probably going to have a sound body. And while this is generally true, I think it's got it backwards. From what we've learned in the 21st century from trauma therapy and from neuropsychiatry, it's become clear that really the body comes first. So it should be, if we have a sound body, then we will have a sound mind. Let me explain what I mean by that. I think it's fair to say that most of us tend to live more in our heads than in our bodies, right? We're much more in touch with what we're feeling and thinking with our minds than what we're feeling in our bodies. I know that certainly is true for me, or at least it has been most of my life. Through my experience of my own therapy as a patient, through my studies of some of the newer developments in neuropsychiatry, I think I've hopefully begun, even at this late age, to be more aware of what's happening in my body and to realize just how important that is. I think one of the most important discoveries of modern neuropsychiatry is that feelings or emotions don't originate in the brain. They originate in the body. Now, for many people, that's been a rather startling discovery. You mean that if I feel angry or sad, happy or inspired, anxious or depressed, those feelings aren't starting in my mind or my brain? How can that be? Well, What we've learned is that feelings begin in the body, normally in the gut, and then they travel through the vagus nerve, which is the largest nerve in the body, going from the gut all the way up to the brain, and are transmitted to the brain, and then we are aware of them. So that becoming aware of what we're feeling is really a secondary step of something that has started already before in the body. And while this is a relatively new discovery for medicine and psychiatry, it's not really a new idea. Humans have been, I think, unconsciously and intuitively aware of this for millennia. The ancient Hebrews wrote, "My kidneys weep," or "My liver mourns." And think of how often we say things like, "I was so disgusted I could throw up," or "That was so wonderful it really warmed my heart." And since the beginning of literature, we've always been an equation of good feeling, warmth, love with the heart and so many other organs. So I think on some level, we've always intuitively known that our feelings have their source in our bodies, but our minds, which take up so much of our attention and energy, have often failed to grasp this basic truth. Once we do understand or at least acknowledge it, I think it has all kinds of implications for our health and well-being. So let me tell you a bit about how this has developed in the field of psychology. One of the real pioneers in discovering the nature of the body-mind connection was a German psychiatrist named Wilhelm Reich. Way back in 1932, Reich wrote a book called Character Analysis, in which he suggested that we all developed what he called body armor, that we unconsciously use the muscles of our body to defend us against unwanted feelings. He felt that feelings literally become trapped in the muscles of our body. For example, one who has a lot of unconscious anger that they don't want to own may keep it trapped in a tight jaw, which might even change the way their face looks. Or one who has a lot of unconscious shame might keep that feeling trapped in their shoulders, apparent in their hunched over posture. And there are many, many illustrations like that. Now, this was a major discovery by Reich, but it largely went unnoticed for quite a while because Reich had some controversial ideas that he took a bit too far and which got him into trouble. He suggested that energy in the universe, which he called orgone, could be transmitted to the body by sitting in a metal-lined box, which he called the orgone accumulator. He created these boxes, wooden boxes, with it was like tinfoil lining the inside. You would sit inside and then close the door. And he felt that this energy that would come to you when you sat that way could heal all diseases, including cancer. The FDA forbade him to use this box with patients with these unsubstantiated claims. He refused So unfortunately, they took him to prison and he died of a heart attack in prison, which is very unfortunate. But what he had discovered about the mind-body connection and the trapping of feelings in the muscles was not totally lost. And finally, in 1969, a biologist named Ida Rolf developed a type of deep tissue massage, which involved actually separating the fascia from the bone, a very painful, deep form of massage. It was a procedure that was quite popular in the 1970s. It was called Rolfing. And Rolf felt that this procedure would attune one's body to the Earth's gravity, resulting in better physical and mental health. And while this proved to be a little bit like Reich's idea of Oregon, and it wasn't substantiated scientifically, what did come out of the Rolfing kind of massage was that people who were undergoing that found that often they would experience strong emotions and even flashbacks of early trauma when certain muscles got touched in that deep massage. And that gave credence to Reich's idea that feelings do indeed often become trapped in the muscles in the body. Now, this led to the emergence of different schools of psychology that felt that the body should be given more prominence in unearthing and processing deeper unconscious feelings. And one of those schools which came into prominence in the 1970s was called bioenergetics. It was developed by a psychologist named Alexander Lowen. He wrote two popular books. One was called The Language of the Body, and the other was simply called Bioenergetics, which he described as the revolutionary therapy that uses the language of the body to heal the problems of the mind. I was in therapy in the 1980s for a few years with a bioenergetic therapist. He had me assume very uncomfortable positions, but positions which are almost like yoga positions, but were difficult ones. They would cause my body to vibrate. And what would happen when these vibrations would happen is that it unearthed deep feelings that had been bottled up for decades. And I found this very helpful. But perhaps the most significant development in body therapies occurred in the 80s and 90s after the war in Vietnam. One of the results of the war in Vietnam was the formation and understanding of the concept of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, which had not really been discussed or acknowledged much at all before that. It became clear that many who fought in that war were experiencing trauma that seemed to be painful and debilitating. And while counseling and talk therapy were helpful to a point, it often seemed like it wasn't enough. It wasn't quite enough in helping to overcome the trauma. It became clear to some that the source of the trauma perhaps lay more in the body than in the mind. And that led to the development of trauma therapies that focused on the body as a place where the problem manifested itself. Now, many kinds of trauma therapy emerged over the years, but there were two that stood out and still stand out as being the most helpful and successful: the trauma therapy of Bessel van der Kolk and the somatic experiencing therapy of Peter Levine. Now, van der Kolk is a Dutch psychiatrist who's played a major role in working with victims of trauma. His famous book, The Body Keeps the Score, which I highly, highly recommend, is worth reading. He explains his method in the following words. Van der Kolk says, "Trauma victims cannot recover until they become familiar with and befriend the sensations in their bodies. Being frightened means that you live in a body that is always on guard. Angry people live in angry bodies. The bodies of child abuse victims are tense and defensive until they find a way to relax and feel safe. In order to change, people need to become aware of their sensations and the way that their bodies interact with the world around them. Physical self-awareness," says van der Kolk, "is the first step in releasing the tyranny of the past." I like that. Physical self-awareness is the first step in releasing the tyranny of the past. Now, this signaled a whole new way of working with victims of trauma. A major example of that currently is the work of Peter Levine. He's an American psychiatrist who in the 80s and 90s developed what he called somatic experiencing. He wrote a book called In an Unspoken Voice: How the Body Releases Tensions and Restores Goodness. I recently took an online course led by Levine, and I must say I was really impressed with the work that he did with trauma victims, which he illustrated in his course. He had a way of looking at somebody and immediately being able to see where they were holding tension, where they were holding feelings in their muscles. And Levine offers some very helpful exercises that he says can help anyone to calm the body and mind when you're feeling anxious or very stressed. One was simply to take your right hand and place it under your left arm, and then take your left hand and grab your right shoulder, and then hold tight. And while doing this, don't think, don't try to think what's happening. Just be aware of what you're feeling. How does that feel? Just pay attention to what your body is feeling and enjoy that feeling. In most cases, it will calm the vagus nerve and relieve much of the stress that you're feeling. Another position he suggested is placing your right hand on your forehead and your left hand on your heart and just holding it that way. And while holding that position again, just try to feel, what is my body feeling? This again can do a lot to calm feelings of stress. Now, both van der Kolk and Levine don't suggest that therapies focusing on the body replace talk therapy. Rather, they suggest that when you're dealing with trauma, we need to begin with the sensations of the body. And once we're in touch with those sensations, then we can talk about it with a therapist. Then we can talk about the trauma, relive it, and get over it, hopefully, and work it. Levine called this working from the bottom up first before working from the top down. Now, what I find wonderful is how consistent this is with what Buddhism teaches us. In his book, Peace is Every Step, Thich Nhat Hanh, who I think understood that feelings are rooted in the body, said, when you wake up anxious in the morning, say, hello, my anxiety, how are you today? Let me give you a hug. And that simple but beautiful statement, what Thich Nhat Hanh is saying is, your anxiety, your feelings do not define you. When I'm anxious, it's not a question that I am anxiety. Rather, it's a question of I have anxiety in my body. And there's a part of my conscious mind that can separate itself from that anxiety and can speak to it and try to calm it. When you think about it, one of the reasons that meditation, I think, is so important and so helpful is because it forces us to take our attention away from the mind and to feel the sensations of our bodies. And breathing is such a big part of this. The simple Buddhist saying, take three deep breaths, is so helpful and so wise. When we are about to lash out in anger or to act precipitously in ways that we might regret, just taking the time to take three slow, deep breaths before responding, before saying or doing anything, can make a big difference because that breath originating in the body calms the vagus nerve and will often cause us to feel stability and not say or do the thing that we would have regretted had we lashed out immediately. Trauma therapists work a lot with breath. There are many different patterns of breaths that can be helpful in releasing tension and calming the mind. There's one that's where you take in short eight deep breaths and then you, I mean, short eight breaths in, eight breaths out. There's others where you take in four breaths, hold it for 5 seconds, and then release them. Many, many different exercises that seem to be helpful in calming. One that Levine uses, which he calls the VU breath, like VUU, VU, the VU breath. He suggests that when you are feeling overwhelmed by stress, it can be very helpful to inhale deeply and then exhale with the sound VU. I'll try to illustrate it. It sounds like this. VU. Now, what I would like you to join me with this, you at home or you in the temple. Let's try to do this together once and just see what it feels like. So together, if we would all take a deep breath and then boom. Feels good, doesn't it? Levine has noted that just doing four or five VU breaths can lower one's blood pressure by as much as 30 or 40 points. The vibration that comes when you breathe with that breath automatically has a calming effect on the vagus nerve and then thereby on the mind. Of course, becoming attuned to our bodies is not just for the purpose of calming stress or trauma. It's a way of promoting generally good physical and mental health. And there's so many parts to this. Recently, somebody asked me, how do you stay so healthy at age 85? Actually, in a couple of weeks, I'll be 86. If I'm honest, it probably has a lot to do with good genetics and also has a lot to do with good luck. But what I responded was four things that I have found essential or helpful for me. First, simply and understandably, eating a healthy diet. Organic food when possible. Avoiding too many carbs, which admittedly is one I often struggle with because I have a sweet tooth. But just eating healthy. Secondly, keeping active, which has two parts to it. The first one is simply getting sufficient exercise. And for many people, all you really need to do is to walk like a mile and a half or 2 miles, 3 or 4 or 5 times a week. And that sufficiently will keep your cardiovascular system in good shape. But there's also a second part of keeping active, which I think is even more important, and that is maintaining daily contact with family and friends and colleagues. Isolation, especially later in life, is bad for both the body and the mind. And I think a lot of us discovered that during COVID when we were stuck many times at home alone. Third, getting sufficient sleep. If I have to remain in bed 10 hours in order to get 8 hours of sleep, I'll do that. I'm fortunate to have a schedule that permits that. Not everybody has that luxury. But trying to get that 7 or 8 hours of sleep every night is so important. And sleep deprivation is one of the major contributors to stress. Fourth, and perhaps most important, working at trying to minimize stress. Using the tools that I've learned in my Buddhist practice, meditation, healthy breathing, and the commitment of trying to live with compassion and empathy. Sometimes I think we make the mistake of being too analytical about what we are feeling. If we feel short-tempered, anxious, or out of sorts, we may find ourselves trying to figure out what is psychologically wrong, like trying to psychoanalyze ourselves. What's causing me to feel this way? And often I think that can be a painful waste of time and energy. This became apparent to me about 30 years ago when my father died. I had always been prone to anxiety, and I spent a lot of my adult life trying to analyze myself, which may be one reason why I became a therapist. When my father died, I had a lot of anxiety, and I went to a new therapist, which was one of several I've seen during my life. And she said to me, "You know, the way your anxiety manifests itself, I wonder if this isn't a physiological thing. I think you might have mitral valve prolapse." Now, I know that I'd always been told that I had a heart murmur, but no one had ever used the term mitral valve prolapse. And as I studied that, I became aware, first of all, 15% of all people do have a heart murmur, which is mitral valve prolapse. But most of them, it's asymptomatic. There are no symptoms. But for a few, including myself, like myself, there is symptomatic mitral valve prolapse, which causes many things. One is being more prone to anxiety. Another is having symptoms like palpitations and an overly active adrenal system, which is called dysautonomia. Once I realized that this is what was causing a lot of my anxiety, when I would get anxious, I would simply say, "Oh, well, there's my mitral valve doing its thing again. This will pass." And it did. And just that awareness played a major part in my being able not to be stuck in the anxious feelings. And I think there are many other physiological causes of psychic stress that we're not always aware of. Things like low blood sugar, a thyroid problem, or a food allergy. Which is not to say that there are not also many psychological issues that can be at play here, and certainly a moderate amount of self-examination is a healthy and helpful thing. But I think we need to be more attuned to the possible physical factors that cause emotional stress. The older I get, the more I realize how important it is to take my body seriously, to pay attention to it, to listen to what it is trying to tell me. When it's trying to tell me something, what is it saying? And to realize that in the end, there's a lot more wisdom in this body than in this head. In many ways, I feel like I'm still a novice in trying to achieve that. There's so much more to learn. But one thing I think I'm finally learning, better late than never, is that if I have a sound body and pay attention to that, I will likely have a sound mind. Thank you for letting me share these thoughts with you this morning.